Good morning, Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. Excited to be here with you as always this Blackout Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving over here. One of the busiest bar days, if not the busiest of the entire year. And it's going to be a long day for me. I'm expecting to be up here for 24 hours straight pretty much, Matt, okay. To get this going. You know, got up about 4:30 this morning and plan on being up at 4:30 this morning on the other end of things as we have one of the busiest bar nights of the entire year. As we discussed last week, this day really has it all because you've got the holiday tomorrow. Just about everybody's got the day off, right? Every school, every banking institution, even most restaurants, quite frankly, aren't open on Thanksgiving. And everyone's got those family obligations. You know tomorrow you've got to be with Grandma. You know you've got to be with Uncle Pat. But your friends are in town. You haven't seen them in a year or two. You want to go out somewhere? Where are you going? A bar, my friend, right? So any restaurant that's got any semblance of bar, any bit of alcohol serving component to it is going to be absolutely rocking tonight. And I get very excited about that one. This goes all the way back to when I started as a dishwasher working in a restaurant in Detroit in 1990. And Thanksgiving always has a big meaning in Detroit, Michigan, because every Thanksgiving, the Detroit Lions play football, right? We get to get disappointed every single year. It's sort of like our Super Bowl because we're kind of the lousiest team in the NFL. We have this history of ineptitude, right? Any team can basically have a bad century, Matt Neely. And so, like, for us, this was like our one opportunity to be on national TV. That game's history goes back all the way to 1934. But football on Thanksgiving actually goes back to 1869 with a couple of Philadelphia cricket teams playing against each other just after the Civil War. The first college games happened in 1876, just a few years later, and we've had pro football on Thanksgiving since 1934. The newly created Detroit Lions figured out a way to broadcast this game on WJR and sell the rights to NBC so that this would be broadcast nationally. And we actually won the first football game on Thanksgiving, 19-16, against the evil Chicago Bears. Little did we know we wouldn't win too many more after that. I think they tricked us on this one. We got pretty excited about it, and ever since then, it's been a Thanksgiving tradition. The Dallas Cowboys started in 1966 and adding a second game to that. And recently in the last couple of decades, the TV stations have added a third game, but it isn't tied to any specific professional team. Only the Lions and the Cowboys have that degree of Thanksgiving specificity. What also happens right around Thanksgiving, and it's got a lot of meaning this week in Tucson, is the Territorial Cup, right?
Yes.
This is the game between, of course, the University of Arizona and that group they call Tempe Normal, I think, up in Phoenix.
Teachers College.
And we've been playing for the Territorial Cup since 1899. It's actually the oldest trophy, like, in the history of college sports. You know, playing against each other now for 126 years, we have playing the Territorial Cup against these guys. And this is the first time since 2014 that each of the teams have at least 8 wins. And so it's pretty neat to have some real significance to this game as well, too. If you look at the college football rankings, Arizona State's ranked number 20, and the University of Arizona just cracked into the rankings at number 25 as well, too. So we both happened to be ranked, adding to the fun on this one. If you remember a couple of years ago, I think it was about 4 years ago, they came into our house and drubbed us 70-7 and put up that no pity for the kitty sign.
Indeed.
That we all had to look at when we drove to Phoenix for a couple of years over there, along with those airport signs chiding us that perhaps had we flown to US, we would already be there right now as well, too.
Right.
And so we got to see those two.
And Chris Edwards' son.
Yes, and his son as well. And yep. So, you know, we had the opportunity a few years ago under Jed Fish's leadership when we finally beat them in football. If you remember, I created that GoFundMe and we raised, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to rent billboards on the SR 143 that said better than the Devils on many levels. And that way Michael Crow could have to see our most recent basketball and football score on his way to work every day for like 4 months. And so I was pretty excited to do that one. So we're really excited for this game. It's going to be in Tempe. It's 7 p.m. It's on regular Fox, so it's a night game as well, too, which is pretty unusual for those ones to fall on Black Friday. It always seems to be a day game for Arizona State. So we're going to Mountain America Stadium. I still call it Sun Devil Stadium in my head, but of course, it's got a corporate sponsor, as our stadium does as well, too, right? Our first game last Saturday was at the newly crowned Casino del Sol Stadium over there. I'm still waiting for the professional sports gambling to come here in Southern Arizona, quite frankly. I think it's just a matter of time before we're able to place bets on those games. Right. Hey, there's just no way.
You can probably do it from your phone, technically, right?
You certainly can, right? And there's a number of companies that do that. But how far are we really from being able to make a prop bet at the stadium? If you'd have told me a decade ago that I could buy a $15 White Claw at the stadium, I would have said, no way, that's not possible at all. And yet, here we are today, there's self-checkout with $15 White Claws for all of us. So to think that we're not going to have the opportunity to bet on a game at Casino del Sol Stadium at some point, I just have to think that that one is going to be there as well, too. Well, we've got a great pre-Thanksgiving Eve Blackout Wednesday show for you guys today. All kinds of things are happening in the Old Pueblo. On hour two, Matt and I are going to break down a little bit of the RTA lawsuit, right? Farhag's filed a $3.8 million claim against the RTA. And I don't think it's going to get talked about that much on this show, except for me right over here. I read all 18 pages of that lawsuit. And so Matt and I are going to break that one down a little earlier or a little later in this show. And not shockingly, there's going to be ties to our Queen Mayor, a Pima County Supervisor as well, too. And a lot of claims of impropriety going on over here.
Goodness.
I know you'll be shocked by this, Matt.
Shocked. I'm shocked.
Speaking of shocking news as well, former city council candidate Jay Tolkoff was slashed in between our last couple of shows, right? In a home break-in a little less than a week ago as well, too. He may call in for hour two. He had a couple things he wanted to say about that one over there. I saw Jay last night. He's doing well, recovering. Good. You know, has a wound on the side of his head, like on his ear, and is sort of, you know,
slashed in the head with a razor blade, with a floor scraper razor blade.
Yeah, crazy, right? That these things, you know, these kind of crimes just continue to happen in Tucson. And Jay got himself an awful lot of press on this one.
Yeah.
Probably more press than talking about middle housing. He got more press than talking about the free buses.
You are so
right. I've actually come up with a game plan for Kathleen Wynne and the Pima County Republican Party over here. And what we need to do is work for minor slashings for our candidates up front.
No.
Perhaps it's a small hatchet attack.
No.
I'm, like Monty Python would say, just a flesh wound, right? We're not going to go for any major injuries here for them.
That's just jokes.
If it bleeds, it leads, Matt. It's on the news.
All right.
And Jay got himself an awful lot of press on this
one. So what I will add, what I will add to your clear and obvious satire is that who is not quoted in any of those articles? Schubert, Ulick, Traceoff, who once held that seat, the mayor. Nobody, the police, were they even quoted? I don't even remember seeing a police quote. I don't know that I've seen every article on this. No quotes from any elected officials on, you know, and Jay's like, hey, look, this was not a political attack. This is somebody robbing my house. But the fact that this guy was the leading candidate from the Republican Party facing off in this, and no official has even commented on what a terrible thing this was. That's what, other than the glaring thing that a guy gets slashed in his own home and the robber says, well, we thought it was empty. We thought it was we were told it's a vacant house. And I'm like, well, first of all, told by who? What kind of an organized, you know, thing is going on here? But, and why does that make it better to, why does that somehow make it right to rob a vacant house, you know? But the fact of the matter is, no officials that I saw, and if I'm wrong, I would love to see the article, but no officials really sounded off on this, which is concerning.
Without a doubt. And certainly I'm not trying to make a connection into the slashing of Mr. Tolkoff with political violence per se. There doesn't seem to be a connection between those. It really just seems to be an unfortunate incident. But it's yet another unfortunate incident that continues to happen inside of Midtown, inside the city of Tucson. And these just continue to alarm me, and I find it more and more disturbing. And it's just one of the many reasons that we don't see more investment into Midtown Tucson are because of crime like this happening in our city, and it really breaks my heart. Speaking of crime going on, if you saw in the news this weekend, Tempe Tavern. Now, normally I wouldn't be talking about things up in Tempe Normal over here, but because this is Blackout Wednesday and we're talking about busy bar days, a bar in Tempe was busted this weekend with 249 minors cited for underage drinking, right? 246 of the 249 were cited and released. Three were arrested. But imagine having, like, your patrons, like, think about the capacity of a restaurant bar, right? There are plenty of places that don't even have a 300-person capacity. That's actually a pretty sizable place.
Sure.
When 249 of your patrons are minors, like, what percentage of that was your overall client base? 80? 90? 100?
What's the fire code on Tempe Tavern? And let's back into what the percentage of the clientele was.
So I did a little bit of research because the liquor violations are, of course, public information. And this bar was cited both back in March and April, like, so early this year. Yeah, I think it was 169, right, issued only months prior. And yet these guys are still operating over here. Like, I get it happening to somebody one time, right? There are certainly scenarios where people use their big brother, big sister's ID. We've all been there. The statute of limitations, I think, has passed on this one, Matt. So I think we're okay in saying that. But 249 people is just over the top. In all the years I've been in the restaurant and bar business, this is the largest busting of minors I've ever seen in restaurant bar history.
So my take on this whole thing is things may be a little subdued at Sun Devil Stadium because the underage college students are going to have nowhere to load up before the game. Tempe Tavern's off the. Well, maybe they're not. I mean, they didn't stop them back in April, so.
Well, for those of you going to that game on Friday, 7 o'clock, maybe we should all meet up ahead of time at the Tempe Tavern, have an adult beverage over there.
Lord.
Check out the crowd. See what that fire certificate of occupancy is, because it is certainly going to be.
And if there's a bunch of bicycles chained up in front that the kids rode, that's your first clue that you have more bicycles than cars and that you're allotted a bar.
Without a doubt. I mean, it's just a terrible thought to overhear it.
Skateboards.
And it's going to be interesting to see what sort of punitive process comes from the Arizona Department of Liquor on an establishment with just that egregious of both a quantity of offenses and quantity of underage minors in that one as well, too. And it makes me think about tonight with being Blackout Wednesday. There's going to be some big crowds out there. So for those restaurateurs that are listening, please pay attention to those IDs and watch this one over there. Why don't we take a quick break over here, Matt? When we come back, we're going to have one of my favorite politicians in Arizona from the Arizona Corporation Commission, Ms. Leah Marquez Peterson, coming up after the break. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Kruger on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger, and we are lucky enough to be joined live in the KVOI studios by Miss Leah Marquez Peterson from the Arizona Corporation Commission. Good morning, Leah.
Good morning. Great to join you.
Hey, thanks for spending part of your Wednesday morning with us over here.
Yeah, I just heard it's, the biggest bar night tonight? I've got to call my husband. It's time to go out.
Blackout Wednesday, right?
Blackout Wednesday.
Maybe a name that does line up with the Arizona Corporation Commission, seeing that you guys oversee power, distribution and charging in the state of Arizona, right? We don't want to talk about rolling blackouts over here.
That's not in our vocabulary at the commission.
Understood. But why don't we start by a little bit of your background? We had the opportunity of getting to meet when you ran the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce for the better portion of a decade. I think we joined back in about 2011 or so when Union opened
up. Which we so appreciate.
And you were a real force in that organization as well, too. Why don't you give our listeners a little bit about your background?
Yeah, so let's see. Prior to the chamber, actually, many people might not remember, but I used to own a chain of gas stations and convenience stores. So I had 6 locations around town, about 50 employees. Did that for 7 or 8 years. I then had a business brokerage firm helping people buy and sell businesses. And I mention that because all of that entrepreneurial experience really was beneficial when I later became the president of the Tucson Hispanic Chamber. I did that for almost, I think, a little over 9 years. We grew rapidly. We really worked to help serve the small business community throughout the region. We had offices and interaction, not just in Tucson, but in Douglas, Sierra Vista, Nogales. We did work in northern Mexico. And really our push at the time was small business advocacy. So did a lot of work with our elected officials at the state, the federal, the local level. And that's what got me interested ultimately in being in politics also.
One of the things I really appreciated about the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce under your leadership was the fight against Proposition 206 in 2016, which was the Arizona minimum wage increase, which unfortunately passed. And we've been feeling those effects ever since. And the Hispanic Chamber, the Tucson Hispanic Chamber, now it's the Southern Arizona Hispanic Chamber, but at the time, the Tucson Hispanic Chamber was one of the only business advocacy groups in the state to stick up for this one and to try to fight these particular increases. Yeah. I remember going on TV and saying, when this happens, you know, like this fight for 15 is going to create a $15 a la carte hamburger on every restaurant menu in the state of Arizona. And they called me a heretic at that time, I think, on KVOA. And look where we are today. Eight or 9 years later, a $15 hamburger would be an absolute deal.
Yeah, and you're right. And actually, I co-chaired that on that proposition because I thought it was important that a Southern Arizona voice be at the table. Small businesses were at the table. A lot of the propositions for and against are led in the Phoenix market. And I think it's still important that we continue to have a voice and representation.
You're one of the strongest voices in politics in Southern Arizona. You happen to be the only elected from Southern Arizona in the statewide offices, no?
Right. That's correct. It is surprising, but it is tough to run statewide. You go to every corner, every town, every community in the state talking to groups that will allow you in and speak to different, whether they agree with you or disagree with you. And so doing that from a Tucson or a smaller market, and when you're not from Maricopa County, is challenging. But I, you know, have been blessed to win my election twice.
Without a doubt. And you've had other elections as well, too. I remember you ran for Congress in 2018 against Ann Kirkpatrick in what was formerly CD2.
Right. So very proud to have won the primary. That was my very first election. I didn't even run for like student council before that I ran for Congress.
Which is a pretty big leap when you think about it. Like, hey, you know, I'm going to come right from the private sector, just right into Congress.
Run in there. I just felt that urge. I thought I could really make a difference. So felt very passionate about the primary. Unfortunately, I ran against someone who had been in Congress before. She had a great ability to raise money and so on. And unfortunately, that's really how you do well in Congress, is you've got to get the word out and be on TV and radio and so on. So unfortunately lost the general election. But that led to Governor Ducey appointing me to the commission at the beginning, and then with the understanding that I had to run for election to keep the seat right away.
Right, and that's a statewide race now, right? And these are partisan positions. There's an R or a D next to everyone's name that runs for corporation commission.
Right, so I had to win a primary and then later a general to keep the seat.
Yeah, that's no easy feat to do as well. I mean, a former Tucsonan, Rodney Glassman, ran for one of those seats a few years ago, too,
if
I recall.
He did, yeah. He did. And it's hard, too, because not many folks know what the Arizona Corporation Commission does. So for me, I try to speak in every club, church group, rotary, chamber, you know, throughout the state that I could get to folks that aren't always maybe as engaged in elections, to explain how important the commission races are.
So why don't you talk about that a little bit? Like, what does the Arizona Corporation Commission do? I think of it as registering my LLCs every time I create a new company, but that's one tiny, small
aspect of
what you guys
do. So we're a 5-member board, again, elected statewide. In other states, if folks are listening and they're from other states, they tend to be appointed by their governor, their public utility commission. But in our case, we're elected. We regulate private and investor-owned utilities. So that's in electricity and water and gas and wastewater. So in our market here, that's Tucson Electric Power, that's Southwest Gas. We regulate close to 350 water utilities throughout the state. If you've heard of Global Water, Arizona Water, Sahuarita Water, things of that nature. We also manage railroad and pipeline safety. And as you mentioned, we incorporate all the businesses in the state, and we tackle securities fraud.
Wow, that's a pretty big plate there to keep an eye on statewide.
It is. It's been so interesting. I feel like I've been on the commission now over 6 years, so I'm one of the longest serving right at this point that's on the commission, and I feel like I have a master's degree now in electricity and water and gas and wastewater. I mean, I've learned so much. I really have enjoyed the position.
But think about how much Arizona politics are tied into all of these things when we think of power. Oh, there's this little thing called Project Blue that's been on the news over the last few months here in Arizona. Water rights are an issue that just continues to dominate Arizona politics, and rightfully so as well, too.
I think of the commission is kind of tip of the spear, though people don't realize it, because if there's any growth or development happening in our state, it's led with, do we have available land? Do we have energy? Do we have water? And we're engaged in so many of those conversations. It's been really interesting. In my 6 years here, we saw like slow, steady growth in Arizona throughout the different counties. And now we're seeing astronomical growth with data centers and semiconductor and manufacturing facilities, especially in Maricopa County. I mean, they're expecting to double their energy load in the next you know, 5 to 10 years. So we're trying to balance all of those needs, and certainly priority being the residents that are already here in Arizona, the businesses that are already here. But how do we balance the need for energy load and ensuring it's affordable?
It's not an easy question, for sure. I mean, one only needs to drive out to the West Valley and look at parts of Phoenix when you think of Buckeye, that 20 years ago were just the sticks, right? Sorry for residents of Buckeye out there listening.
Or Orange Groves, right?
But you were deep out there, and now all of a sudden there's more cranes in the West Valley of Phoenix than there are in like the whole rest of the state combined. And then you look at even the growth that's happening in Pinal County as well, too, with what they've got going on in terms of manufacturing and semiconductors. Conductors and all these things. Like, I feel like that we're constantly just behind and further behind here in Pima County to these other places in the state that are just growing at a far faster clip.
Yeah, I mean, situations like kind of the public relations nightmare that Project Blue unfolded to look like, that doesn't help in terms of economic growth in Pima County or the Tucson area. So I think folks are looking, for available land. Arizona looks attractive. We've got a great business climate. We're a regulatory-friendly state. So I think we're a place people want to come, but ultimately for us, a lot of it comes down to water, right? Availability of water, and we don't want to see groundwater used for manufacturing processes or cooling data centers and things of that nature. So we have to get beyond that if we want to grow and figure out a win-win solution for the community and companies that might want to come to Arizona.
Without a doubt, water's been a big issue. You know, it's been on the top of our news cycle with Tucson Water looking to charge differential rates between City of Tucson residents and those in unincorporated Pima County. Maybe we can take a quick break and talk a bit about that after the break over here. We're with Arizona Corporation Commissioner, Ms. Leah Marquez-Peterson. Thank you for spending part of your Wednesday with us. Don't go anywhere, listeners. More fascinating talk about Arizona and the Corporation Commission and all the things they do to help regulate utilities in the state when we come back after the break.
Hey, Val Romero, Chris Edwards, Jesse Lugo, Sixto Molina, and our leader, Dr. Ed Ackerley, and some U of A students are delivering 150 Thanksgiving food boxes prepared by Chef John Hone and his culinary team at Gap Ministries to 6 schools. So thank you to all the Morning Voice listeners for the help and support of the Coaches for Charity Thanksgiving Food Drive.
Thank you, Matt, and welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. We are joined live by Ms. Leah Marquez-Peterson from the Arizona Corporation Commission, and we were talking before the break of all things that the AZCC does, right? Regulating utilities in the state of Arizona, and that includes water. And water is a pretty big deal here. The City of Tucson has recently decided to start charging differential water rates again between city residents and unincorporated Pima County residents. Does the Corporation Commission have any say in what the Tucson Water charges as a utility?
Yeah, and we don't. And that's a good thing to point out here. The number of phone calls and emails I receive, Grant, because I live in Tucson, is crazy. But I would tell them, no, the mayor and council are the ones that lead and ultimately vote on rate increases for Tucson Water. And that is an unusual way to structure water rates. We typically base it on tiers in terms of usage, and you pay more or less based on how we structure those, not based on whether you're in the county or the city. So I think there's still lawsuits pending, I believe, on that case. I live in unincorporated Pima County, so certainly was not happy to see the differential. But that's certainly an issue for mayor and council.
Without a doubt. And that's such an unusual circumstance, the way they get to do it and just vote on those particular rate increases. It doesn't go to the Corporation Commission for like a rate case in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't go to the voters. They can sort of just unilaterally decide. It also looks like the city has been exploring the possibility of creating their own electric utility as well, too. Because TEP is a Canadian-owned company, right? And they are under your regulation.
They are. We do regulate them. I've read those same media stories. Very concerning. It's a very complex acquisition, if that's what it looked like. It's got so many moving parts. It's not something that I think would best serve Tucson residents, but you know, they can certainly explore and do what they'd like, and we'll see what happens. We would ultimately be a vote and whether or not something like that would be approved, though, at the commission.
So let's talk about rate cases for a moment. It was in the news this summer that TEP was asking for a 14% rate increase. And this came only days after the whole Project Blue thing blew up as well, too, where we're saying, hey, we don't have enough power to potentially, give services to this data center. We don't have enough water to cool this data center. And then the next day, TEP is like, oh, by the way, we're going to file for a rate change over here. And so there's a case without violating any of your your responsibilities on the Corporation Commission. Can you explain how this rate case works? Like, how does TEP ask you guys to raise their rates?
Yeah, so this is a primary function of the commission, is we hear 40 to 50 rate cases a year. We regulate about 400 utilities. So they put their application, their package together. It's based on historical spend. So the challenge with the TEP rate case being announced when it was, as you mentioned, right, on the heels of the Project Blue issue, is people mixed this up and thought one was related to the other, and they are not. So when TEP filed their rate case, and any listeners can certainly read their rate application, you can weigh in on this, you can send emails to the commission, and it goes within a docket, like an online legal folder, so we all five of us can review that. All of that can occur, but the TEP rate case is for the hundreds of millions of dollars they've spent historically since their last rate case. And we then vote on those financials and determine what's just and prudent, is the legal language that we are held accountable for. We go through kind of with a scalpel and decide what works, what doesn't work, what should be in the rates, what should not, what should be base rates, what should be surcharges on your, and things of that nature. And so we'll be doing that with TEP and APS, which is the large electric utility in the Phoenix area, pretty soon.
Sure. So now Phoenix is blessed, of course, with the Palo Verde nuclear plant, right?
Yes.
Which can produce an awful lot of clean energy. And clean energy is sort of a buzzword that everybody talks about, right? You hear about solar and wind, and everybody wants this. What's your take on clean energy? Like, what defines clean energy for you?
Yeah, it's carbon output. I think nuclear is definitely a clean energy source. It's one of the greatest assets we have in Arizona. It provides about 30% of the energy to the entire state. TEP is not a owner of Palo Verde. I understand they originally were, and then they changed things after that opened in the late 80s. So there are seven owners partners on Palo Verde. And if you read through the news, or you kind of Google what has the commission been talking about, we've been having a number of nuclear workshops. We've been talking about what would make sense in the future, an additional unit maybe at Palo Verde, or small modular nuclear reactors. In the state, there's a lot of conversation around nuclear around the nation.
Do you think that we could put another nuclear plant in the state of Arizona? If Palo Verde is giving us 30% of our power right now, and we're seemingly so short, could TEP just create their own utility? Could mayor and council run their own nuclear plant?
No comment. I do not know. But I will tell you that at the Palo Verde facility, there is space for another unit, and there's so much excitement around the possibility for nuclear, but the biggest challenge we all face is it's very expensive. Georgia, the state of Georgia, recently opened two new units called Vogtle that were way over budget. It actually bankrupted one of their contractors that was working on it. So we really need to study what is the best balance, who should be the partners, these data centers and tech companies that are coming into the state, should they have some kind of financial input into some new nuclear site? Should small modular nuclear be behind the meter somewhere in the state? I mean, there are all these conversations that are occurring, and it's all being developed all at the same time. One of the challenges we have with small modular nuclear are there about 10 different types of technologies that are being tested around North America, not just the U.S., but in Canada, who've been really aggressive on nuclear also. And so without one or two specific types of technology, we aren't seeing the efficiencies yet that you would see on new technology of this sort. So there's still time will tell. It's still years away. But I serve on a co-chair an advanced nuclear state collaborative that pulls all the state energy offices and our commissioners together that are interested to just educate ourselves on what's happening in other states, what legislative policies might be changing to help onboard nuclear or promote it in rural communities versus urban or things of that nature. So we're studying a lot of the nuclear space.
So what are your opinions on solar energy? And in a sense, yeah. Arizona as a state logically has just about more rays of the sun than any other state out here. And so you would think it would be so impactful. And yet with the federal subsidies on this one expiring, it doesn't seem to necessarily pencil out for the average consumer to put solar, say, on their homes if it's got a 10, 11, 12-year payout, you might be better off just paying your rates to TEP, even with their 14% rate increase, than buying solar and betting on the come. What do you think?
I mean, solar is one of the less expensive ways in which to generate energy. It's definitely a huge asset in the state of Arizona. It's more efficient for us to build utility scale solar, which is what you see the panels out in the desert, or you see it south of the airport. You see a lot of development happening. I was out visiting with APCO, which is out in the Wilcox area this week. They're building a huge energy center, solar and battery farm up in the Pinal County area. SRP, which is another big utility in the Phoenix area, building a huge energy center in Pinal County also. So there's a lot of solar development occurring. The challenge we have, though, is solar doesn't work at night, right? So we need to have a constant source of energy, which is tending towards natural gas in our state. So you need to balance that natural gas infrastructure with solar, with battery. Someday, batteries will live beyond a four-year or four-hour time cycle. Right now, they store about 4 hours of energy. So there's more and more technology being developed to last longer, 8 hours perhaps, and some of that's being tested, pilot tested. But we're not there yet with the batteries. But that could be a good solution also for solar in the future.
Because in my sort of utopian view of the universe, like, it would be amazing if you could actually have solar panels on your house, powering your electric car, powering your electric appliances, and living in this sort of net zero world. But I was at a breakfast a couple of years ago with Susan Gray from TEP, and I asked her point blank. I was like, Susan, if everybody in my neighborhood had a second or third electric car, right? And you're talking 220, three-phase power, right? Heavy stuff, like what your dryer plugs into. And they all plugged in their electric cars at the same time and started to charge. Would my neighborhood's power grid hold up to everybody charging two electric cars simultaneously? And she said, absolutely not. And it was kind of shocking to me. I was like, here they're trying to shoehorn this product down our throats, and yet our own grid, our infrastructure can't support that right now.
Yeah, they're programs, without getting too wonky, but they're called demand response programs, where we could create a program where you would plug in your electric vehicle, but it'd be scheduled at a certain point so that it's all spread over the evening hours. Maybe your EV's charging it midnight, mine is 2 a.m., or so that we're not putting as much intense pressure on the grid. So there are programs like that we're working through with the utilities.
And I know those exist. You can plug in your on-demand, you know, time-based pricing as well, too.
Right.
And some of these programs, your Tesla can know, well, the power is cheaper at 3 in the morning when no one's drawing versus 3 in the afternoon. So if you're fortunate enough to be able to have the leisure of charging your car over the course of the next 24 hours or so, this could work for you.
It could,
if you absolutely, if you're planning on going to Phoenix tomorrow, right? And as somebody that commutes up to Phoenix quite regularly,
yes,
you know, these things pop up. There are use cases where, like, you've got to charge now and it doesn't matter what the rate is, you're just ready to go. And so I see all of this as being a big challenge moving forward.
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of programs here in Tucson called Smart Rewards. In Phoenix, it's called Cool Rewards, you allow the utility access to your smart thermostat. You might have a Nest thermostat on your wall, and they will cool your home during the day and then raise the temperature during peak time, 4 to 7 p.m. That's prime time in Arizona during the summer. That's when we have the greatest demand for energy on the grid. So if we can lessen the use from 4 to 7 p.m., it's just better for all of us. We save that energy load, and prices are lower for folks if they can lessen their need at that time. So trying to grow interest in smart rewards at your home and then potentially your business, depending on what type of business you have, I think it's a great thing. APS is one of the most successful programs in demand response in the nation.
And TEP has this as well too, right?
Yes, it's called Smart Rewards here.
And so you can reach out as a person or as a business to ask about Smart Rewards?
Yeah, if you go to TEP.com and there's a search bar at the top, just put Smart Rewards up there and their program will pop up.
Very cool. I'm going to have to take a look at that for our business as well too. Why don't we take one more break over here? We're going to have one final segment coming up with Leah Marquez Peterson from the Arizona Corporation Commission, talking all things utility distribution in the state. You're listening to The Morning Voice. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger. One final segment with Leah Marquez Peterson from the Arizona Corporation Commission. Leah, it's been big, big news, all these data centers popping up over the state of Arizona, or potentially popping up.
Right.
Project Blue was the big one here in Tucson that drew the ire of so many people at that city council meeting when the city chose not to annex this property. They chose basically not to bring a $100 million water pipeline, reclamation pipeline to and through that site. Like, these things are going to come up either way. It sounds like we're getting data centers somewhere in the state, no matter what we do, correct?
So I go to a lot of conferences to learn more about my industry, and every single one of them has a whole tract on data center growth. So it's not just Arizona, it's around the nation. The number one state in the country is Virginia. You're seeing lots of growth in Texas, and Arizona's right up there, probably in the top five. We already have about 150 data centers in the state. When I speak at a Rotary or a chamber, I start with, why do we need more data centers, right? Let's make sure we all understand. And it's ChatGPT and the use of AI, and it's uploading things to the cloud and just growing and growing exponentially. So these data centers need to be somewhere within the nation, right? It's also, I think, important that it stays within the nation, and we need to find a space for them. Whether a community wants one or not, totally up to their mayor and council or their board of supervisors. That's what you saw play out here with Project Blue. The county board of supervisors voted to rezone the property, so legally you're able to build that type of facility on that piece of land. And then the mayor and council had passed a rule in the past, I'm sure you talked about this on your show, that if you're to use Tucson water, you must be annexed into the city of Tucson. And that was the whole fight we saw play out in the media, and ultimately they voted no, so there were no benefits to the city of Tucson. Now, this issue on Project Blue will be before us at the Corporation Commission soon, but we are voting on just the special contract or the tariff, the rate in which that user will be charged for electricity. We're not voting on yes or no or zoning or anything to do with water. It's all about the special contract and the protections for the ratepayers. Any of the five of us on the commission talk about the fact that whatever comes to the state, whether it be manufacturing, semiconductors, data centers, growth must pay for growth, right? If you're coming in as the big user, you need to pay for your substations, your infrastructure, perhaps the generation that's coming to serve your load. And so we're putting protections in place in a special contract and voting on that in the next week or so.
Leah, are you seeing this visceral reaction to the protesters about the problems with the power grid in the data centers, now multiple that are being proposed in Pinal County that you saw in Tucson?
That's a good question, Matt. We hear from folks in different spots within the state. A lot of times it's misinformation, not understanding what's coming or what's there or what are the benefits to the community. We do hear from folks, though, and when I speak at conferences, I'm often asked, what's the biggest challenge facing Arizona? And a lot of it's NIMBYism, right? Not in my backyard. So whether it's, I don't want a data center, I don't want to see solar panels out the window, I don't want to see wind farms, I don't want natural gas plants or things of that nature, I get it. It's your private property. You have an opinion. You know, certainly give that to your mayor and council and your board of supervisors, ultimately get that to the Corporation Commission. But we're not voting on what's there. We're voting on the rates, the capital structure, maybe the transmission connection to that site. A lot of those decisions are made at the planning and zoning commissions of these counties. And so it's important to weigh in. And we've seen moratoriums pop up in different parts of the state where they've said, this county will have a moratorium on solar. This county will have a moratorium on natural gas, meaning things won't be built like that. We've also heard that regarding data centers in some different cities. So it's challenging, I think, for development and for builders, depending on what they're building, to come into any state right now. They've really got to work with the local community to make sure they're balancing the needs of that community with what their industry needs.
And we've seen a lot of challenges here, of course, in southern Arizona with that, right? The NDAs, the lack of disclosure, the lack of information, at least to the general public, right? Over things like utilities, as you've educated us on this morning, yeah, that are very public processes. At the Arizona Corporation Commission, you can zoom in, right, and see these meetings. You can leave comments. Where do people send comments to if I want to leave a little beef about what's going on with state energy? How do I do that?
So you can just go to azcc.gov. You'll see our five photos on there. You can click on any of us, find my photo there, and send me an email, and I'll put it in the docket, which is like the online folder related to that issue. We get thousands of letters, and I appreciate that. I mean, I don't want to just hear from lobbyists. That's probably the biggest surprise that I had as a new elected person or appointed person back in 2019, is there's so many lobbying arms. And I knew that, but boy, it's different to be on the other side of that. I like hearing from small business owners, from residents, and not just form letters, right? 1,000 of the same letter doesn't have as much impact as you telling your story, attaching your bill perhaps, and saying, I have questions or concerns about this. So I encourage folks to weigh in.
I love it. Well, Leah, we love hearing from you as well, too. So I just want to say thank you for spending part of your Wednesday morning with our listeners on The Morning Voice and educating us about the Arizona Corporation Commission.
Yeah, thank you, Grant, for having me.
No, thank you.
And happy Thanksgiving.
And we look forward to hearing more from you over here in the future. I know you're going to term out in a couple years on the Corporation Commission over there. So you got over 1.4 million votes last time. So maybe there could even be a bigger political future for Ms. Peterson over here.
Time will tell. Who knows?
I love it. Don't go anywhere, listeners. We've got a whole nother entertaining hour of The Morning Voice coming up after the break. We're going to talk about some restaurant openings and closures. We're going to talk Blackout Wednesday. Matt and I are going to break down the RTA lawsuit and all kinds of fun things on The Morning Voice. It's been a pleasure with you, Ms. Peterson. Thanks for spending part of your Wednesday with us. And one more hour of The Morning Voice coming up after the break. Welcome back to hour two of The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger, on this Thanksgiving Eve, a little Blackout Wednesday show for you over here. Did you know, Matt Neely, that Thanksgiving got moved to the third week of November back in 1939? That historically it was celebrated as the fourth week of November, but President FDR moved it 1 week earlier to create 7 extra shopping days to help get us out of the Great Depression over here. Commerce is just everywhere, right? It's just always designed for us to buy
sure.
in some capacity. So in 1939, Thanksgiving was moved to be officially observed on the third Thursday of November, as opposed to the fourth, and something called Franksgiving at that time was what it was called. And so those 7 extra shopping days are going to be here for you as well, too, starting out this Black Friday, right?
Right.
I don't know if Black Friday has as big of a meaning anymore as it used to, right? Who's going to the shopping malls these days? There's that whole Cyber Monday thing as well,
you don't have
too.
The brawls out in front of Zodi's or, whatever your department store and their doorbuster specials and people duking it out in line.
Remember, people were camped out and whatnot as well, too.
Best Buy. And, yeah.
Speaking of camped out, last year I brought to our attention that people were camped out for the opening of a Sweet Tomatoes restaurant on Broadway, right? After the 133-unit chain closed down during COVID, the one and only Sweet Tomatoes in the United States opened back up in Tucson, Arizona. Now, I take big note of this one because it was one of the only ways I could get my two daughters to agree on a restaurant to eat at. Getting my daughters, Elise and Kira, to agree in a restaurant was like reaching a peace accord with the Israelis and the Palestinians. But if I mentioned Sweet Tomatoes, it was a universal appeal, they were in, right? That deal was signed. And so we were pretty excited. Now, there's been a second Sweet Tomatoes location that's been sitting abandoned in Tucson for the last 5 years now, right? And absolutely falling apart. This happens to be at Stone, right? And the Wetmore area, right? And that 4420 North Stone. We used that parking lot 2 years ago at the Tucson Conquistadors to park cars for the La Paloma Golf Tournament. And I was able to get a peek inside of that Sweet Tomatoes because the homeless had broken in and left the doors open. And so I got to wander the bones of Sweet Tomatoes and look at what a Sweet Tomatoes would look like in sort of a Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome post-apocalyptic situation. And it was pretty wild, needless to say. That location was absolutely stripped and destroyed. And it was pretty heartbreaking to think of all the great meals I had had there with my kids finally agreeing to eat a green vegetable.
Yeah.
And yet there was no more green vegetables to be found at all.
And want to know what's coming out of the ice cream machine there, because it could be some sort of chemical concoction.
Certainly was just meth and fentanyl at that point as well, too. So it was announced this week that a new restaurant was popping up in Sweet Tomatoes. I had been seeing construction, the roll-off dumpsters and the white trucks. And naturally, what I do is I look for the liquor license applications to see if it was out there. And there was nothing there. But it breaks on the news this week that Lynn's Grand Buffet is taking over the Sweet Tomatoes. So they are the nation's largest Asian buffet chains. They've got one in the I-19 corridor on the south side in Tucson now. So they're opening their second Tucson location immediately across from the Tucson Mall at 4420 North Stone. So Lynn's Grand Buffet is going to take the former Sweet Tomatoes location. Now, I'm not knocking Lynn's. I'm sure it's a fine concept. And hey, anything that brings jobs and hot food into Tucson and the city, I am all for it. But I'm also a little heartbroken. I was really hoping for Sweet Tomatoes 2.0
a little closer.
To come. Yeah, it would have been not only a little closer, it could have presented a little more family unit immunity to my kids, they would have had a little bit more green vegetable rather than just eating pasta and pizza. So I'm not going to be able to realize that dream with the second sweet tomatoes
so
yet.
So I think, though, you've hit on something. I didn't realize, you did mention this before, I just kind of slipped my mind, but on the Welcome to Tucson signs, we could add home to the nation's only sweet tomatoes restaurant. Yeah. I mean, that could be a market differentiator for us.
Right. I mean, we had the 23 miles of Mexican food and then the best Mexican food in America. We could have only sweet tomatoes in America.
Not every city could have the largest ball of twine or, you know, the largest foil ball or something like that.
Well, because we have the only one, we have the largest sweet tomatoes in the entire nation here as well, too.
Largest and only and smallest. Really, I mean, yeah.
Correct.
Want to go there.
The hits keep coming. So either way, a new location popping up over here on Stone. Excited to see something happen in that space because it was really getting pretty run down. And so it's great to see some economic development happening in the city of Tucson. It's a 7,700 square foot building. So that's a whopper. That's a big restaurant. Not a lot of people go out and make restaurants of that particular size. Last week, we talked about the Kingfisher having lab-grown salmon on their menu. Remember that one?
I do remember that, unfortunately.
And a bunch of controversy broke out in the news yesterday with the Campbell's Soup Company because one of their executives was taped saying terrible things about the Campbell's product, right? That it was, quote-unquote, food for the poor and that this was lab-grown chicken, right, inside of the soup products. And of course, Campbell's immediately is on the defensive and says, oh, of course, this is not lab-grown meat. This meets all the USDA standards, and I'm sure it's cage-free chickens or something along these lines, right? That's in the Campbell's chicken soup. But it's yet another inkling of what's coming in the future, this Soylent Green thing, Matt, that I've been talking about. We're going to hear more about this over the next couple of years as meat, as animals become just more expensive to both grow and house and butcher and feed America, at what point are we actually taking a slab of chicken or beef DNA and growing it in a petri dish somewhere and then grilling it and seasoning it, maybe a little MSG on there for flavor in some capacity? And at what point is that not making it on your plates of, say, chain restaurants, right? What's already in the McDonald's hamburger? Yeah. What's in the Taco Bell grade D beef, right? The lowest grade fit for human consumption. Anything less than that is pet food. Like what's in these products now? And again, I'm not knocking the McDonald's or Taco Bell guys. I've certainly, you know, eaten and enjoyed those products before in my life. So I'm not pontificating from someone that hasn't consumed it. It just makes me wonder, like, when we're going to really crack open this Pandora's box on this lab-grown food products. Yeah. Well, and I think it's coming sooner than later.
On top of all the market forces and whatever, that the availability and, you know, heck, the room to graze all these, you have a significant portion of the population that actually sincerely believes that cow flatulence is going to somehow destroy the atmosphere, is going to destroy it, put a hole in the ozone. So, I mean, you know, on top of the challenges of feeding more and more and more people, you also have a bunch of people that, like I say, walk around every day believing sincerely that that live cattle are bad. So
Without a doubt, it's coming in the future, guys. It may not be on the plates of your locally owned restaurants as much. I think it's going to make its way into larger national food processing companies, i.e. your Campbell's soup, i.e. your fast food meat products distributed to all 50 states, produced in some sort of giant commissary laboratory. But it is coming, and it's kind of gross, and it's kind of weird. But I think it's something that we really all need to watch out for as consumers, because it's just a matter of time. We talk a lot about data centers and whatnot, and these are sort of like the data centers of food, where you've just got the Ciscos of the world, the Shamrocks of the world, you know, producing and carrying product like this. Yeah. And when it comes in at half price, like, and it's going to be in a meatball, you know, where does that go?
Ironically, you know, this guy that at Campbell's Soup, ironically, he was in the IT department. So, of course, he knows everything about the supply chain and how it's made, of course. But ironically, the IT guy is calling out where you're going to be able to get an HP, you know, food printer at some point. And I don't know, it's a HP steak printer or something.
Yeah, it's just a matter of time, Matt. This is coming. What doesn't seem to be coming, though, unfortunately, is the Tucson baseball team. Gosh, like, we've canceled yet another home series. So we've basically gone through the entire months of October and November at this point without home games for the Tucson baseball team. I looked up their regular schedule, and it goes until December 30th. So we do have a few games, you know, in the low teens right now left in terms of home games that could potentially be salvaged should they be able to work out this visa process and get that team to legally be able to play here inside the United States. But it's looking less and less likely to me. I mean, at this point, we're already two-thirds of the way through the season, Matt, right, and we haven't yet had a home game in Tucson.
Well, I'll tell you what, here's what I think they should do, because I don't think it's going to be processed in time. I just, again, I've talked about this before. Any process that involves background checks on people, just by definition, takes a while to do. It just does. I mean, and then you throw in the government shutdown to top everything off. But what they should do is, for the last couple of homestands, call those an exhibition, because they do already in their hands have the correct visas for a short-term exhibition kind of thing. So I think, you know what, if they get towards the last two homestands, call them an exhibition, and I think they're covered for like a couple of brief weekend stays, because they already do it. They already have that for like the Vamos a Tucson and whatever
the
they
Mexican
call the Phoenix
baseball
one.
Fiesta, yeah, and things,
yeah,
of that nature.
And whatever, yeah, they call the Phoenix branch of that. And so so I think they should be at least be covered for the last couple of homestands, just calling them exhibitions. I believe that they should be covered.
I love it. I'm really heartbroken that this has happened to the old Pueblo, as we couldn't have been more excited for live professional baseball over here. And it just seems to be slowly slipping through our grasp, particularly when you think of what the weather looks like in December. These were always going to be the dicier of the products either way, is what does that temperature look like during first pitch?
Good point.
Speaking of outdoor venues out here, the MSA Annex has announced two new restaurant openings, adding to the number of businesses out there. And so Boss Burger, a Japanese-inspired burger joint, and Hidden Hearth Bakery, a specialty whole grain bakery, have just announced that they're going to open up. Boss Burger is going to have their grand opening on Monday, December 8th, and so that's coming up in just a week and a half or so. So we're pretty excited to see those ones popping up in the MSA Annex. It's neat to see businesses make their openings here in Tucson. Of course, they're scrambling to catch any part of season that they can right now. And so we're looking forward to those ones. So do go out there and visit the MSA Annex right at the very stop of the streetcar out, yeah, there by at the Mercado San Agustin. This is that sort of box card addition that they put out there as well, too.
Related to what you just said, do you know, are these going to be boxcar restaurants with seating outside like is already there? I think there's a couple of places there.
Yes. My understanding is that these are both going to be boxcar-based places, so not a traditional 8,000 square foot restaurant. It's not a Lynn's Grand Buffet over here. There's not room
Nice way to tie it back.
I would love to have a Sweet Tomatoes in the MSA Annex. If you're listening out there, Rio Nueva,
back, man.
Let's,
nice.
let's figure that one out over here. But let's also hear from a couple great local advertisers. Matt Neely and I, when we come back after the break, we're going to break down more issues affecting you in the city of Tucson. We love talking all things local on The Morning Voice. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Kruger and Matt Neely on 1030 AM. Welcome back to The Morning Voice, your exclusive stop for all things local Tucson every weekday, 7 to 9 AM. On Mondays, you've got Lydia Aranda. On Tuesdays, Ted Maxwell from the Southern Arizona Leadership Council, RTA Board, and other amazing things. On Wednesdays, you've got me, a bit of food for thought, local restaurant, business development, news, and just a hint of politics. On Thursdays, Tom Moulton from the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance. And on Fridays, Dr. Ed Ackerley bringing you wonders from the University of Arizona.
And again, Dr. Ackerley says thanks to all the listeners who helped out with the Thanksgiving boxes for Coaches of Charity. Those are going out to the six schools this morning. Ed's got his team. He's got Sixto and a bunch of other good folks, and they're out delivering those to, and the schools are going to make sure those Thanksgiving dinner boxes prepared by Iron Chef Award winner John Hone, yep, and his team. And he's going to make sure that the schools are going to make sure that those go out to deserving families at six local schools. So
I love it. That's so awesome. And that's the kind of cool local news you get to hear on things like AM radio, like 1030 AM over here. Some other things you may or may not get to hear are the swearing in of our city council people. I've been really concerned because, you know, like over these last couple months, we heard over and over again about how Adelidra Gahalva did not get sworn in for 7 whole weeks, that those residents of CD 7 went disenfranchised, and that even though they had canvassed the election, they didn't swear her in in a timely manner. Well, the Tucson City Council election was canvassed on November 10th, according to my calculations over here. And so it's been a number of weeks now where the residents of Wards 3, 5, and 6, right, are disenfranchised by not having Miranda Schubert and Kevin Dahl and Selena Barajas sworn in. In fact, it will be over 4 entire weeks since, you know, that election, since they will get sworn in. But for those that are concerned at home, if you've been tracking this and you're really worried about it, your dreams are going to be answered this upcoming Tuesday, December 2nd. And they're going to get sworn in. There's a ceremony starting at 9:30 in the morning. And so our new city council folks will be crowned. I was a little worried because how were we going to get those 7-0 votes, you know, over and over again if they didn't get this done? And this election had been canvassed a long time ago, Matt. And so, so I was a little concerned.
Well, maybe they could make a spectacle of it. I mean, they've got the ice rink outside of the TCC and swear them in on ice. I mean, just make a total spectacle out of it.
So speaking of the ice rink at the TCC, you know, segueing into this one over here, that was supposed to start on Sunday. I was actually pretty psyched about that one. Sure. Roadrunners games on Saturday and Sunday. I met with Bob Hoffman. We were ready to go, and it turns out there was a bit of an equipment failure with the ice. It turned, you know, there's a lot of cooling and issues that you have to do when it's 6-7 degrees outside, as Matt would say, keep a sheet of ice working outside. And there were some problems with that. So it's now going to open on the 28th. So they punted just a few days on that one. But soon enough, you'll be able to go to the City of Tucson's website and reserve some ice time. It's $22, right, for an hour and a half. That includes skates. And they've got skates all the way up to size men's 15, they said, Matt. Okay. So you've got some Sasquatch feet out there. They've got you covered the City of Tucson. So that's kind of a neat thing if you haven't got a chance to go out
Grant
there ice skating.
You want to get out there and like check some people into the glass and do a little high sticking. And
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, this reminds me of like being in Michigan. You could put on your hose in the backyard and to come out the next morning, you just had an ice rink
out
there,
rink.
Right? That doesn't quite seem to work as well here in Tucson. And with the differential water rates that I'm now paying, I don't know that I can afford to leave that hose running in the backyard in the same way either.
The differential rates?
Yes.
You couldn't afford it even if it was cold.
Right. So if you can't afford that and you don't want to try to freeze your own rink, you can go out and rent ice time starting on November 28th. So a little delay, 4 or 5 days there in the City of Tucson on this ice rink, but still a pretty cool thing that we're bringing. That's right across from the TCC. So right next to where their big multi-story parking garage is over there, that ice rink is there, and it's $22.
So if people want ice downtown, they have to get meth, I guess, these days.
Right?
So, thank you. So, thank you very much.
It is safe to say that is true, that there's different forms of ice you can get downtown. $22 is on the higher price compared to some of the market value of other ices. As well, I took note there's a third candidate now in the state attorney general race.
Yes.
Already that was kind of heating up, right? And in Republican circles, there's been a bit of a division between current Arizona Senate President Warren Peterson and well-known former Tucson City Councilman Rodney Glassman.
Speaking of ice rinks.
Yeah, yes. I like the tie-in. And we've had both of them on our show over here, and I think both would create a compelling alternative to the incumbent that's running out there. But if there wasn't enough division in the Republican Party, we thought, you know what, this gubernatorial race looks awesome as a three-way race. Why don't we make the attorney general one also be a three-horse race? And so Scottsdale attorney Greg Roberg has formally entered that race. And he's an America First candidate as well, too. Made a big media stop on the Steve Bannon's war room, supported by Steve Bannon, has announced his candidacy for attorney general statewide. So now it is a three-horse race for state attorney general on the Republican Party side, much like the gubernatorial races as well, too. And so this is going to create a lot of division, I think.
I will tell you that no matter which of those three candidates win, I can guarantee you, Grant, that there will be fewer porch pirates in the state attorney general's office if one of those three wins than there is currently.
Yeah, you may be correct over there. It's a... It, it's going to be an interesting race as the Republican Party continues to tear each other to pieces in primaries, right? Like, you don't see a lot of contemptuous primaries on the D side of things. Deja Fox, candidate for CD7 outside of things, but she was kind of a political outsider. But mostly, they tend to line up and pick their people and make sure that they don't have to go through a contemptuous primary that costs you an extra $1 million worth of fundraising or something along these natures, so that you walk in wounded into the general election, not being able to financially afford this one. You're not going to see big challenges on the Democrat side for governor. You're not going to see big challenges for attorney general. Will somebody put their name in the race? Of course, these are high-ranking political positions. Somebody can go out there and cobble together 1,000 signatures and get their name on the ballot. But like real heavy-hitting politicians, you're not going to see it in the same way you see the Republican Party do this one, where we're going to end up in a big dogfight, much like what we saw with Carrie Lake and Karen Taylor Robeson, much sure. like what we saw with Blake Masters in that Senate race, in a five-horse race, mm-hmm. where by the time he came out of it, he just was bringing a knife to a gunfight against Senator Kelly to win that race and was outspent like 8-1.
Sure.
And so I'm concerned about this, not because of the process. It's certainly America, yeah. and we have a right to have primaries. But I just think that the Republican Party needs to line up a little nicer and play nicer in the same sandbox and take a look at who's leading these races and figure out a way to get the other ones to step down to better the cause. Otherwise, our candidates are going to continuously have challenges.
It's true. I mean, on the other end of the spectrum, you have Kamala Harris, who was a horrible candidate with no, and there was zero primary, and she was basically selected for a lot of bad reasons. But on the other hand, right, you can have a very bruising primary, and I guess the argument could be made that that does sharpen up the candidate who eventually wins if the field isn't cleared, but you do run the risk of hurt feelings by large voting blocks that maybe don't show up on election day.
Right.
A general election.
And just one of the continued challenges we have in our primary system over here. If there was an equal challenge on the D side of things, and at least both candidates were going through this sort of brutal vetting process, it would make more sense. But it just seems like one party knows how to line up its troops a little better than the others. And we're going to be staring down the barrel of that, not just in the gubernatorial race, but in the state attorney general.
Look at Adrian Fontes was pushed out of the race in the primary, possibly saving a bruising Democratic primary for the CD7 race.
Yep, and it's happening in CD6 as well too, Matt. You're seeing that one where the other candidates have all stepped down on the D side that are going to challenge incumbent Juan Ciscomani. Well, don't go anywhere. More fascinating local news and talk on The Morning Voice coming up after the break. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. So many things happening on this Thanksgiving Eve over here. Blackout Wednesday. It's going to be a rockin' night out there. Be careful if you're out there on the streets after 10 p.m. because it can be a bit of a scary place. Take those ride shares. Enjoy the benefits of technology allowing us to enjoy Blackout Wednesday responsibly as well too as you celebrate this Thanksgiving Eve. What did break this week as big news, as we talked about at the beginning of the first hour, is a lawsuit from former executive director of the RTA, Farhad Moghimi, right? And Farhad has decided that he is going to sue the RTA for improperly firing him. And he's got a $3.8 million lawsuit going up against the RTA. And
not chump change.
Yeah, that's not chump change. And so it's an 18-page document by the Jacobson Law Firm, and not the Josh Jacobson Law Firm, for those of you keeping track over. This is not Tucson crime-free, although it might be an improvement. But I went through this one because Farhad was fired in a five to four vote, right? That the RTA board has 9 members to this. And it's basically the heads of the various municipalities, you know, think Tucson and South Tucson and Marana and Oral Valley and whatnot. It's also got the tribes. And then there's somebody from the State Transportation Board, which happens to be our very own Ted Maxwell, right? From Tuesdays.
That's the radio silence on Tuesday on the matter.
Amazing why this didn't get talked about. And I'm not knocking Ted for that one. Like,
no.
I wouldn't be talking about that one either if it was involved in litigation. And in fairness, Ted's vote was to maintain and keep the employment of this individual. But he's claiming being improperly targeted for a number of enforcement issues and improper benefits going to, not shockingly, to the mayor's son over here. But let's tie this back to Supervisor Matt Hines. There was a worker at the RTA who was using her corporate email to stump in 2016 for now current Pima County Supervisor Matt Hines. And so this individual was chastised by Farhat for saying, hey, you can't use your RTA email to campaign for or against any ballot initiative or any candidate at all. And so this individual was very upset by this particular chastising and sort of took it on herself to continuously attack the executive director of the RTA over basically the next 8 years. And over this 18-page document, Matt, it lays out everything that she did, including getting onto this RTA Citizens Advisory Board and absolutely pounding and pounding Farhat and finding ways to get rid of him. And so suddenly, when Farhat brought this to their attention, and then in 2022, he also brought up a youth arts program that the RTA was funding that Regina Romero's son participated in, and saying that this could be a conflict of interest, that maybe these are things we shouldn't be doing and having your children in these programs where public money is being spent on this one. It just looks bad. And so Farhat, in terms of blocking these campaign, you know, illegal campaign offerings, and in terms of standing up to the mayor and saying, hey, maybe your children participating in this program is a conflict of interest, suddenly became a persona non grata. And when the changes happened in the RTA board in March, April of this year, right, when Adelita resigns from the Pima County Board of Supervisors, yep. Right, Rex Scott moves to the chair, like suddenly
you
Rex
change
is,
in dynamics.
Yep. And suddenly Matt Hines, the gentleman who has had an axe to grind against Farhat for a long time because of these political dealings going all the way back to 2016, suddenly becomes a member of that board, as does Roxana Valenzuela, right? The South Tucson mayor, who's of course tied, you know, as we talked about, to Bill de Blasio and of course tied at the hip to the city of Tucson. South Tucson is talking this week about canceling their fire department, like, yes, potentially just not even having one, right, anymore because they can't afford it, and using the city of Tucson services for this. So imagine they're not going to go too far or stray too far from the city of Tucson lest you bite the hand that feeds you.
Literally, yeah.
And so ultimately, the makeup of the RTA board changes with Valenzuela and Hines going on this one. And the first thing they do is call for Farhat's firing. And this happens in a 5-4 vote. Those two votes, Valenzuela and Hines, suddenly were the ones that tipped the scale to fire Farhat. And so he's upset at both the political process that happened behind, where he had called out the mayor and called out the Hines campaign team for using, yes, the RTA to campaign for him. And then, of course, he's got complaints that open meeting laws weren't also followed with this, and suddenly the RTA, who already has some underfunding issues and aren't going to be able to complete all the projects promised us in 2006 for a myriad of reasons, many of which had nothing to do with Farhat, right? He didn't even become the executive director of the RTA board until 2013, according to my calculations. And so ultimately, Farhat wasn't responsible for all of this. He picked up the pieces 7 or 8 years later after the creation of the RTA, and he gets canned in a very political process in a very narrow vote, 5-4. And so he's suing for $3.8 million right now, which is a chunk of his salary that he would have realized, I'm sure, over the next decade or two. And while I don't know about the merit of his employment contract, that gets into really deep into the political weeds over here, and we're already pretty deep on this one, he does seemingly have a bit of a case here against these two Tucson politicians, one on the Pima County Board of Supervisors and one said Queen Mayor, who they do really seem to have an axe to grind against him over here. And so this is going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Grant, first of all, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to read this. I hadn't gotten to that, and I'd seen the article, obviously, as a lot of us had. This is fascinating. The thing that fascinates me most is that to anybody that has not read this or has not listened to the last 5 minutes of this program, the city had kind of a badge that they could run this firing on that the city of Tucson wasn't getting the attention from RTA. And legitimately, in people's minds, the city had created that impression, right, that the city of Tucson was being somehow picked on by the RTA, and that Farhad was not a cooperative for the whole region, only he had certain areas that he would favor, right? So I think a lot of people have that perception. And without knowing any of this, yeah, all this stuff makes the firing look very, very bad. Before, all of a sudden, well, it's a political thing. The mayor wants more, and this is the only way she's been threatening, right, for a couple of years to walk from RTA, and Tucson will do its own RTA, its own transportation without being part of this regional group, right? So they've sold this thing so well. But then when you look behind the scenes as what's going on, yes, that's a bad look, and it's going to cost whoever is going to end up paying this, if it's the city or if it's RTA or Pima County Tax, somebody's going to be writing a check to this guy, I think.
Well, on top of that, the city was due to write checks for a number of projects happening inside of the city, Matt. Because when the RTA half-cent sales tax was determined in 2006, they came up with a cost structure and a plan for each of these projects that were going to be encompassed by this. And any overage at all was supposed to be paid for by the municipality that was benefiting this. And so where Farhad is claiming foul is that the city of Tucson asked for additional funding on a multitude of RTA projects.
Yes.
And then he denied them, saying, no, according to the RTA agreement, rightfully so, that you've hired me to oversee, right, to shepherd across the finish line, these additional add-ons, even if it was a cost overage tied to inflation or COVID or whatever it might be, the municipality has to pay for this. And if you want to use municipal funds to do this, you need to go to the voters. And Tucson wasn't having it.
Right.
And that's why they got rid of him. That's why they brought in Mike Ortega, because he was their boy at the city of Tucson to run the city as well, too. And as such, the city is firmly in control of the RTA in a level that they weren't even in March of this year. And they're driving the bus, and the new RTA plan is going to reflect that as well.
Yeah, yeah. And this whole thing, I mean, you use the word ex parte communication, but it's, and I'm using it in sort of a different sense. This is something that Farhad knew, and Hines knew, and Romero knew. They all knew about this behind the scenes drama, but you know, it was never discussed publicly. It was hidden from the public. Well, now that he drops this lawsuit, this goes, you know, public. Yeah, Farhad talked about this on this program with Ted, I believe. You know, hey, if cities want to make some scope changes to projects, they're fully welcome to do that. They also need to fund those. You know, that's the ground rules that all of the cities and governmental entities that are part of RTA all play along with.
Without a doubt. And so there's some skeletons in the closet over here about what happened politically behind the scenes. Now, there's three sides to every story.
There are.
Right?
Mayor and Hines are going to say, well, this is blown out of proportion, and this is mischaracterization, of course.
Right. And I'm willing to accept, you know, that this is Farhad's side of the story.
Yes.
But this also tracks with the behavior we've seen in the city.
It tracks with the viciousness of the way he was treated as soon as Rahina knew that she had, the mayor Romero knew that she had maybe a working block that could do something.
And this is coming at the absolute worst time for RTA Next, which is, of course, not the renewal of this tax, because they have to package it as a whole new tax, but a continuation of a half-cent sales tax as far as the status quo goes for us here in Pima County, that we would have to vote for this. It's coming up in March 10th. It's only a few months away right now. It's our next upcoming election. Yet another off-cycle election there, Matt, at a cost of $1 million. And now you've got a lawsuit coming behind you at a potential cost of $3.8 million plus attorney's fees.
Yeah.
And whatever dirt gets dug up on this one is going to hurt the city's chances for an RTA vote that I consider 50-50 right now at best. I'm no political expert here, but watching these ones, like watching the last couple special elections, like it's going to be difficult to convince the general public.
The original RTA vote was kind of close.
Yeah, it's going to be difficult to convince the general public that they want to continuously pay a half cent more for everything out there in the universe right now. Like, I wouldn't be surprised, even though I'm publicly for RTA Next and supportive of it, I wouldn't be surprised that negative news like this popping up helps doom it to failure at the ballot on March 10th as well.
And I'm just going to go back to the well on another subject that I've seen time and time again in my 30 years in Tucson. I wish this lawsuit would have been dropped. Brought up or whatever, notice of claim. I wish this would have come out before the city of Tucson election. Always this happens. It happened after a vote where a tax got voted down at the county, and they said, oh, look, we just found all this money in the cushion, so proverbially. Or after a city council election when Karen Ulick got reelected to Ward 3, after the election, it came out that she had bought a house in Ward 2 and planned fully to live there. That would have been a good election issue for her opponent to bring up, like, hey, you know, my opponent is bailing on you guys. I actually live in the ward. And I see this time and time again where news that would have been helpful to voters comes out after they've cast their vote and the cake is baked for the next 4 years.
Right.
Well, this bugs me.
Well, let's keep an eye on this RTA one over here. We'll put a bow on this one, take a quick break, hear from the sponsors that help support local radio and make talk like this possible. One more segment of The Morning Voice coming up with Grant Kruger and Matt Neely after the break. Hang in there. Welcome back to the final segment of The Morning Voice, your last opportunity to connect on all things local here in Tucson, Arizona before the Thanksgiving holiday. Kathleen Wynn coming up with China Watch right after the break, but I wanted to bring up just a bit of Brazil Watch. We had Combat Coffee on a couple weeks ago. I'm enjoying some Falcon Fuel right now, keeping my long-winded diatribes and soliloquies fueled for you every morning over here on The Morning
Voice.
Thank
you, Dave.
It has been announced that the tariffs on Brazilian coffee, which are up to 40%, were dropped as of November 20th. And coffee prices nationwide have been plunging, which is absolutely fantastic news and music to the ears of restaurateurs and coffee shops everywhere, not just in the Old Pueblo, but nationwide as well, too, as Brazil provides a little more than one-third of all the coffee we have in the United States. And of course, as we talked about on that show with Combat Coffee, there isn't really an American alternative to coffee. Like, if you want coffee, like, it comes from overseas, and it's products like tequila and coffee that make some of the tariffs, quite frankly, a bit challenging and difficult to stomach, literally and proverbially. So we're pretty excited to have some discounts on coffee. Hopefully we'll see some rollback on some of these prices over here, as I'm a big fan of coffee. And you wanted to talk a bit of news about our local Arizona senator over here real quick, Matt. I know we've only got a few minutes left for your seditious acts before Thanksgiving, but it seems that Senator Mark Kelly's got himself in quite a bit of hot water these days, making some comments that perhaps soldiers shouldn't have to follow rules that they consider to be unjust or illegal. Where do you draw the line? What do you think about that one, Matt?
Well, you know, I think The president, I was troubled that he immediately goes to the sedition card. I would have been happier had he said, well, can you outline those illegal orders? Give us some specifics on that, Senator Kelly, because I don't see it.
Yeah, I don't see it as well, too. Shouldn't there be like a process? Doesn't this already exist right now in the military? If somebody did something, whether it was sexual harassment or some sort of unfair workplace,
right.
I mean, we're in a soft enough society that there are complaint departments willing to receive these sort of complaints.
Indeed. I think, you know, that I would think they're given training. I think there's policies and procedures. And one of the news stories I saw said, you know, soldiers can do this, but it puts you out in you are now walking in a very complex landscape, okay, that could result in a dishonorable discharge if you're wrong. I mean, there's a lot of things. If you're going to go there, there's a lot of things you have to take into consideration. If you're going to say, hey, that's an illegal order, and I refuse to follow your order because it's illegal. And you're right. I would think there are enough hotlines, ombudsman, whatever you want to call it, where you could call and say, hey, look, I'm having a problem with this. Can we talk?
Without a doubt. I've seen a few good men, so I must know my way, of course, around the military court system over here. If Santiago orders the code red,
right.
You know, like, there are ways for you to speak up and say that, hey, maybe this isn't the best choice of military force at this particular moment. But we just can't have our soldiers working on their own personal sense of morality, their own moral compass, trying to determine what or is not illegal based on the orders that come down to them. That's just not how the military hierarchy could or should work. We would set ourselves up with absolute chaos if everybody got to use their own moral compass on every order that came down from the federal government. And so this one's going to be really interesting to see how this unpacks over the next week or so, over the holidays, as our own Senator Mark Kelly continues to tangle with the president and gets themselves both into a fair bit of hot water over some really heated discussions over how and where our military should work. And of course, having a big military presence here in Arizona, we tend to, with Davis-Monthan and Air Force Base, it tends to be kind of a big deal. But what's also a big deal is the Thanksgiving holiday. So we're going to wrap up this show on The Morning Voice. I appreciate you all taking part of your Wednesday morning to listen with us. We had a fascinating conversation with Leah Marquez Peterson from the Arizona Corporation Commission. I want to give her a big thank you again for helping explain how they regulate utilities over here. A big thank you to Matt Neely, and I'm very thankful for all of our listeners out there as well, too, that help make shows like The Morning Voice popular and still present. Pay attention to AM radio out there. It's where we get to hear and talk all things local. And so I appreciate you and hope you all have a great Thanksgiving holiday.